that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is September 6th, 2013, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The topic for episode number 43, 1, is the loneliest of numbers. Welcome back, SGEM listeners. Did everyone in the Northern Hemisphere have a great summer? Based on feedback from last year, Season 2 of the SGEM will hopefully be bigger, better, and more educational than ever. You will notice some changes as we move forward, and please let me know what you think of these changes, because I always consider them and appreciate your feedback. We're going to start the SGEM this season with a great show and an amazing guest. I don't know why it's taken me so long to have my mentor on the SGEM. Today we have Dr. Andrew Worster, the EBM guru and creator of Best Evidence in Emergency Medicine, or BEAM. He is the man who taught me every EBM question can be answered with the phrase, "It all depends." Andrew holds the following titles as an associate professor in the Department of Medicine, Division of Emergency Medicine, and in the Department of Clinical Epidemiology and Biostatistics. He's an associate editor for ACP Journal Club and an associate editor for the Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine. All I can say is, wow, you are a really, really smart guy. Andrew, please say hello to the SGEM listeners.
Thanks, Ken, and hello to all the listeners.
I always try to have a case scenario to make the SGEM more clinically relevant. So the case scenario for this podcast is a 43-year-old woman who presents with chest pain for about an hour. The chest pain was at rest while she was at work, and there was no radiation of the pain. She takes no medication, and her medical history includes two previous cesarean sections. She is Wells low and PERC negative. The physical examination and ECG are non-diagnostic. Question we want answered on this podcast is, can a single high-sensitivity troponin rule out an acute myocardial infarction? As you can tell by this question, we are going to be talking about troponins today. But not just any troponin, high-sensitivity troponin. And there have been a flurry of papers published in the last year or so on the subject. How about a little background on cardiac markers before we talk about the cutting-edge research on the subject? And that's why we have Dr. Andrew Worster here. Measuring proteins in the blood to indicate a damaged heart is one of the best examples we have of a biomarker to detect cell death. Research in this field started in the 1950s with transaminases, and there have been many markers used over the last 60 years. Now, I've been practicing, Andrew, since the 1990s, and the cardiac markers of choice have changed just over my career from CKMB to troponin. And this was in part due to the improved time-dependent sensitivity and improved specificity of troponin compared to CKMB. But the ground is shifting in the field of cardiac markers, and there's new high-sensitivity troponins on the market. So we have a sensitive and now highly sensitive markers. I mean, I don't know what's next, Andrew. Ultra, premium, platinum. It's starting to sound like a fancy credit card program or airline rewards program. I'm glad you're here to help sort things out. Do you think you could give us and the SGEM listeners a little perspective?
Well, first of all, Ken, thanks for inviting me here today. I agree that this whole area of troponin is a little confusing. There hasn't been a great deal of regulation from the FDA or Health Canada about this. So industry has sort of plodded along doing their own thing. In fact, I'm sure if you were to ask each of the companies what the definition of high sensitivity troponin assay is, that you would probably get a few different answers.
It would be nice if we had clear definitions, and especially since we're talking a bit of a fuzzy area, because only about 5% of consecutive patients who present with chest pain will have a STEMI. But it's not those people we're really worried about. Those are the easy ones to diagnose. Yes, it's an ST elevated MI. But it's the other 95% of people who come in with chest pain. They're the hard ones, and we need to figure out who's going to rule in and rule out for acute myocardial infarction. And I guess this is really where the cardiac biomarkers play a major role. And you, of course, sent me an email saying that, you know, for decades, you know, the ECG STEMI criteria, that's how we confirmed it. And then we use these other cardiac markers like CKMB.
Right. So, as you said, you know, from Fred Apple's study, about 5% of patients with acute chest pain have a STEMI. Now, keeping in mind, many of the patients with acute MI will not present with chest pain. We know from some of our STEMI work that 1 in 5 of those patients will have completely atypical presentation. We really don't know what that is in the unstable angina, or I should say, in the non-STEMI population. There's a crossover between unstable angina and NSTEMI, and we're using the biomarkers to separate those two apart. This is a difficult area. For a long time, we had these very non-specific markers, which were actually proteins or enzymes from myocardiocytes. So then in about 2000, in the European Society of Cardiology and the American College of Cardiology, certainly redefined myocardial necrosis, making troponin assay army tool for MI diagnosis. Now, they proposed that the troponin value at the 99th percentile of a healthy reference population is a single cutoff value for MI. So what that means is they took a healthy population of people and they arbitrarily said that 1 in 100 would have an MI. Don't ask me how they came up with this, but this is the definition that was set. And that was in 2000, and that's the definition that we've been stuck with. It's the 99th percentile, and that has to be measured with what's called a coefficient of variation of 10% or less. So that means the assay can't deviate more than 10% from that value. In 2007, they updated the definition of MI and advocated a rise and or a fall of troponin over a 6 to 9 hour time period as the definition of myocardial infarction. But last year, they released the third universal definition of MI. That was published in August. Most important thing was that they reduced the timing now from 6 to 9 hours between measurements to 3 to 6 hours. Using a sensitive assay, not a high sensitivity assay, because at that time when they were reviewing the literature, there really wasn't enough out there to talk about high sensitive troponins. As it stands, with most fourth generation troponins, you need to do 2 measurements 3 to 6 hours apart, regardless of the time of symptom onset.
So this is trying to address one of the limitations we all face in the eMERGE. You know, it takes 3 or 4 hours for the troponin to start rising sometimes, and you have to take these 6, 8 serial measurements and trying to shorten that time frame so we can identify those people and get them treatment. But also there's the issue of, you know, taking up a lot of resources, overcrowding in the eMERGE, and a lot of patient anxiety over this.
Right, it's a real challenge. And there are some other things to add to that. In the universal definition of MI, they're quite explicit. If you have an elevated troponin, there are some clinical features you have to have present as well. You have to see a rise or fall of the biomarker with at least 1 value above the 99th percentile and with at least 1 of the following: symptoms of ischemia. idea, you or presume you, ST segment or T wave changes or new left bundle branch block, development of pathological Q waves in ECG, or imaging evidence of new loss of viable myocardium, or new regional wall motion abnormality, or the identification of an intracoronary thrombus by angiography or interpreted autopsy.
Oh, I don't want to be the guy that's diagnosed on autopsy. Thank you very much. When you're going through that list, Andrew, I noticed that, you know, there were five things in that definition, which I really like because five's my favorite number because I can count it on one hand. But, you know, it was the symptoms of ischemia. You've got to have the symptoms. That was number one. And number two was the changes in the ST segments that were considered new or presumed new or with a new left bundle branch block. And the third thing was, you said, developing pathological Q waves. The fourth thing that was evidence of loss of viable myocardium on wall motion abnormalities. And then the last thing, of course, that we didn't want was either the autopsy finding or the intracoronary thrombus. So five things. I like that. Five things that that are part of that universal definition of acute MI, correct?
Ischemic symptoms can be a little bit vague. As you know, different people have different types of symptoms, and some people very atypical symptoms. So this is where things get blurred. If you were to do a troponin, measure a troponin level on someone without any ischemic symptoms, identifiable symptoms, and it came back elevated, the question is, what does this mean? It could mean or would suggest that they've suffered myocardial injury, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they've had an acute MI, which then begs the question, how do you treat them?
I think that's a really, really good point. We certainly have covered a lot of material about these new cardiac markers already, and we haven't even started talking about the specific paper involved. So why don't we laser down here and ask the specific evidence-based medicine question? And that's question for today's podcast is, can a single high-sensitivity troponin rule out an acute myocardial infarction? So, Andrew, could you tell us which paper, because you picked the paper, could you tell us the paper we'll be talking about and give us the PICO?
Sure. So the paper is normal presenting levels of high-sensitivity troponin and myocardial infarction by Heller et al. And this was published in the journal Heart in April of 2013. And interestingly, this is by the same Swiss group of researchers who've done most of the current research on high-sensitivity troponins. And they have a series of studies under the acronym, I pronounce it Apache, but it's APACE.
Yeah, we don't want to get confused with the other Apache score.
Right. Here's the PICO. So the population is consecutive adult patients presenting to the emergency department with chest pain, and they make that a little bit more liberal. So they say acute chest pain, angina pectoris at rest, or other thoracic sensations, presumably caused by myocardial ischemia. The intervention was four different high-sensitivity troponin assays. The comparison was, well, the adjudication was done by two cardiologists independently assessing for an MI at 24 months, and the outcome was death or acute myocardial infarction.
Thanks, Andrew. I really like the fact that we're doing a study from April 2013. Talk about cutting that KT window down from 10 years down to 1 year. The main results, well, they had four different assays, which you alluded to, and they all pretty much came out close to being the same. I mean, they tested between 1,000 to 2,000 patients in each of the four groups. They had about 20% actually ultimately rule in for an acute myocardial infarction. And the sensitivity of the tests ranged from 77% all the way up to 94%. With the negative predictive value, and we'll talk a bit more about that, the negative predictive value was sitting somewhere around 95% for all these tests. You were more likely to rule in for an acute myocardial infarction if you were older, had a previous MI, diabetic, hypercholesterolemia, hypertension, coronary artery disease, already on aspirin. None of these were big surprises. Death in the first 30 days was more likely if you had a positive high sensitivity troponin. Again, not very surprising. Andrew, anything else you'd like to talk about in the results section before we get into sort of critically appraising it?
I want to talk about how they present the results using sensitivity, specificity, and negative predictive values, if that's okay.
Oh, that's great, because then we can jump into slipping in some evidence-based medicine stuff here. Yeah, that'd be great if we can talk about sensitivity and specificity and the negative predictive value. You, please, go ahead.
Okay, so it all depends on what the objective here is, whether we're using the test to rule in or rule out. If we want to rule out MI, then we can do that with sensitivity. But the problem is, as sensitivity falls below 100%, it becomes more difficult to rule out this. Now, people sometimes get confused with what sensitivity means. It doesn't mean what is the probability of a patient with a positive test having the disease. It actually means the opposite. It means what's the probability of a patient with the disease having the test. So it doesn't really tell us what we want to know. Predictive values tell us what is the probability of disease if the patient has a positive test result. It tells us what we want to know. The problem with predictive values is that they are susceptible to the prevalence of disease in the population that you've tested.
So something with a low prevalence can have a great negative predictive value if there's nothing there to find anyways?
Right. Yeah, so this changes things. If you're going to report, or as a reader, if you're going to interpret this with predictive values, you want to be sure that they were studied the population that you treat. Because if they didn't, then you can't know whether these predictive values actually apply to your population.
So I will add some extra information to the blog and show notes there, just to give everybody a quick refresher on the sensitivity, specificity, and predictive values, with some links out to some YouTube videos, because you know what? Every once in a while, I need to refresh myself on this as well. So the author's conclusions for this paper, before we give our BEAM comments here, the author's conclusion for the paper, Andrew, were, quote, normal high sensitivity troponin levels at presentation should not be used as a single parameter to rule out acute myocardial infarction, as 6 to 23% of adjudicated acute myocardial infarction cases had normal levels of high sensitivity troponin at presentation. All right, so let's talk about a paper in general. I'll start, and then I'll bring you in on as the expert. It was a prospective, an international multi-centered trial, and it had a primary endpoint of all-cause mortality. And most chest pain patients didn't have an acute MI. And the test itself missed between 6 and 23% of acute MIs. And I don't think anybody wants to miss sort of 1 in 4 heart attacks. The negative predictive value was, you know, around 95%. And no surprise, the sensitivity and the negative predictive value were better in patients that presented after 6 hours, because, of course, troponin takes time to rise. And there seemed to be a large variability between all four different tests and a lack of sort of standardization. I think you referred to that earlier. And because it's an observational trial, true benefit cannot be determined. So, Andrew, could you give us your sort of expert opinion on this?
Well, I don't know about expert, Ken, but I can certainly give you my opinion. So I agree with the author's conclusion in that a normal high-sensitivity troponin level of presentation should not be used as a single parameter to rule out MI. I'm not convinced that their numbers are correct for a number of reasons. If we look at, first of all, the population that they tested, they focus more on chest pain. And when we look at other studies of patients who undergo troponin testing, know that chest pain represents only about a third and maybe even a smaller proportion of the population. So no doubt a lot of troponin measurements are being ordered on patients who don't have any ischemic symptoms whatsoever, but ischemic symptoms can be somewhat vague and variable. And as clinicians, sometimes we just have to use our gestalt. The patients don't always express themselves very well, and we have to take into consideration other risk factors and things. And that's where we come up with the decision to order the troponin. So there's limited generalizability here. If you just focus on chest pain patients, or patients who can be very specific about thoracic symptoms. So that's one thing. We talked about the vagueness of troponin, and we talked about what is the definition of MI. You know, if you changed the cutoff value from 99% to 98%, that changes what the definition of NSTEMI is. The adjudication was independently by two cardiologists, but they waited, you know, they looked at MIs for 2 years, 24 months. Now, I can't think of a single test that I use in eMERGE where I would say the negative result is valid for 2 years.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed with that 2-year mark as well.
You know, why would they look at 2 years? To me, and again, this is just my opinion, I'm more interested in 1 to 2 weeks because I don't know what's going to happen after that. And in fact, I can't even guarantee that far ahead. Of course, by going to 24 months for follow-up, that gives them a much larger group of population. But I don't think that's really fair.
Not for an eMERGE doc standard, I think. You know, as an emergency physician, I think we're a little bit more focused on the immediate and not the, I wonder what this test performs in 2 years.
Because then it becomes a prognostic test rather than a diagnostic. Because if you're going to have an MI 2 years from now, if I know that it's going to be 2 years from now, I'll tell you to quit smoking, lose some weight, and eat healthier, and perhaps stretch on aspirin. But that's about it. I'm not going to admit you to the hospital for any treatment. So we're more interested in how does the troponin change our management in the ED? Does this patient need to be admitted for some sort of therapy? That's what the troponin should be for.
Yeah, I think that's what we're more concerned about in the emergency department, yes.
Now, the other thing with one troponin, you know, we often talk about, well, the patient's had symptoms more than 8 hours, or their symptoms began 8 hours or more before their presentation. So if I do a single troponin now, and it's normal, that 8-hour period should have been enough for the troponin to rise and be detected. Agreed?
Agreed.
So that's the theory. Here's where the problem is. The patients are not always very good at timelines. They're not very good at describing their symptoms in many cases. What they tell me might be a little bit different than what they tell you. So if we're going with a single troponin, we're going with the assumption that the patient is accurate with the time of onset and with their symptoms. We're also making the assumption that if there was a coronary event, then it occurred at the time of symptom onset.
Yes, at the start, you know, at time zero, oh, I got chest pain, I've had the MI, as opposed to a lead-up with angina or unstable angina, and then 3 or 4 hours into it is when they completely occluded.
Right. So this is the problem. So if you go with one, and in many cases you'll be right, but you cannot be absolutely sure they didn't have an MI. So this is why in the 2012 Third Universal Definition of MI, they've said that everybody, regardless of the time of onset of symptoms, everybody gets two. And you can do those 3 hours apart or 6 hours apart. It doesn't seem to be much benefit in doing them later than 6 hours apart. So one thing you can do in this particular case, we've got this 43-year-old lady. So you repeat the troponin at 3 hours. Now, assuming that her timing was right, you're still only 4 hours after symptom onset. So you may want to do another one at another 3 hours. So this is where clinical expertise comes into play.
So the beam bottom line then, from your standpoint, is that one troponin, even if it's a high sensitivity troponin, is a lonely number, and it shouldn't be used to rule out acute myocardial infarction.
Exactly.
So for the case scenario conclusion then, this 43-year-old woman who had the 1 hour of chest pain prior to arrival, we can get an original biomarker on her, a high sensitivity troponin, but then we will need a second troponin or a high sensitivity troponin, and at least 3 hours after the first one was drawn?
Well, I disregard the timing of the onset of the symptoms and just go with 3 to 6 hours after the first opponent.
Excellent. Okay. So it's time for the Keener contest, and I like to give away cool skeptical prizes. And the Keener contest that we decided on prior to recording the show was to ask the SGM listeners to name 5 causes for elevated troponins. And 5 is my favorite number. So ask for 5. Could you name 5 causes for an elevated troponin? And if you're the first one, of course, to correctly answer this question, you'll receive a cool skeptical prize. And just send your answers to thesgem@gmail.com and use Keener contest in the subject line. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we sign off today?
The only thing I'd like to add, Ken, is for everyone out there to be very skeptical about everything in here, even if it's from us here at the Skeptics Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Thank you very much, Andrew, for being on the show. We'll talk to everybody next week.